You're listening to Heartland Politics with Robin Johnson, a presentation of WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Heartland Politics show and podcast, which is aired on and distributed by WVIK Public Radio in the Quad Cities. WVIK is the flagship public radio station in the Quad Cities region of northwestern Illinois and eastern Iowa. This is your host, Robin Johnson, and one of the major focuses of this show since its inception back in 2014 has been the impact of globalization on the Midwest region and how it impacted us, not just economically, but on our social fabric, our culture, and our politics. The impacts have been profound. I've read dozens of books over the years and had many of the authors on my show, but today's guest has written what I judge to be one of the very best books written on this topic. It's a brand new book that's out. She's Farrah Stockman, and the book is titled American Made, What Happens to People When Work Disappears. Farrah won a Pulitzer Prize for her reporting at the Boston Globe, and she's now a member of the New York Times editorial board. And she has roots in the Midwest. Farrah, thank you so much for being a guest today on Heartland Politics.
Having me on.
Well, you won your Pulitzer back in 16 for some work on looking at desegregation in Boston schools. I'm just curious, first, how this topic came to attract you, and then how it kind of formed into the book and the approach you took in putting the book together.
Yeah, well, I started researching this book literally on election night in 2016. I was stunned, like many people in the Boston area, when so many millions of Americans cast a ballot for a man who had not served even one day in government, and he became the president of the United States. So, you know, I had to start asking around, why Donald Trump? Why Trump? And I'm from Michigan, so I kept hearing back, he's going to save our factory, he's going to bring our factory back. And around that time, he had tweeted about this plant in Indianapolis and that was moving to Monterrey, Mexico. And I decided to follow people at the plant over the period of time that it shut down to really understand, like, what does that feel like to be told that your job is going away because these people over here are going to do it cheaper?
Well, it's a story that we're very familiar with out here, because factories have left quite a bit, and it's had a lot of impact. And I appreciate the way you went about the book, because it sounds very familiar to us here. And there's aspects of the book that we'll get to a little later that make this particularly, I think, unique. But you talk about how the factory is kind of a world in itself. And I think when factories close, people think, well, it's just the jobs that go. But there's a lot more to it than that.
Yeah, for sure, for sure. I mean, that was eye-opening to me to see the way that it was really like an identity. It was, you know, some of those jobs were passed down in families. So it was like a family heirloom almost. It was this, a family identity. It was a status symbol. These were the best jobs, like, you know, in that part of Indianapolis, and, a social network, a bowling team. And so, yeah, I really got a sense of that, and what was sort of lost beyond the paycheck for the families that were impacted.
Your book takes a really close look at the impact on a human level, on several levels, but most importantly, perhaps on the human level through the eyes of three individuals. And without getting to the end, I think readers, I want to leave that open. So readers, if they're interested, will buy the book and read what happens, because it's pretty compelling. But how did you come to kind of focus on the three individuals whose stories kind of tell different angles of this? There's similarities, but there are also different angles about this story.
Yeah, there's a little bit of luck involved. I knew I wanted to follow a woman who worked in the plant because I was so surprised to hear about female steelworkers. But, this was the one woman who let me follow her around, right? She's, you know, not everybody wants a reporter on their tail for all that time. So I followed Shannon Mulcahy, who basically worked her way up from a janitor at the plant to becoming a heat treat operator, which was one of the most dangerous and highly paid jobs on the factory floor. She had been a battered woman. She had been with an abusive guy and got the courage and the money to leave him because of this job. And so her story was really compelling on a lot of levels. And I was really grateful that she trusted me to tell it. I also followed Wally Hall, who was a black man, bearing assembler. And I had met him at a union rally. He was one of the, he gave a fiery speech about interracial solidarity. We got to stand and fight, y'all. And then afterwards, yeah, there's a long line of people wanting to give him a hug and talk to him. And I stood at the end of that line. And then I finally get up to meet him. And he wasn't fiery at all. When I met him, he was super optimistic. He was a believer in the American dream. He was one of the few people I had encountered who had an actual plan for when the factory closed. He said, I am going to start a barbecue. God has closed this plant so that I can pursue my own business. And so I knew at that point I wanted to follow him and see if he actually did it. And then the last guy I followed was a man named John Feltner, who was the union vice president. He was a diehard union guy. He came from a long line of union men. His grandfather and great-grandfather had been coal miners. And he was the one who went around the plant saying, like, nobody train. Don't train your replacement. Don't do it. Let's see if we can keep this plant here by refusing to train. And I just wanted to see what happened to him after the plant closed, because that was his second plant closing. He'd been through it before, 10 years earlier. And so I really wanted to see, like, where does he end up?
I thought, your take on the woman involved, Shannon, I thought was interesting, because if you ask most people their mental image of a factory worker, it's a male. And you bring up some interesting data that this is something that women have gone into more and more over the years. And I really like your description of her as a blue-collar feminist in the tradition of Dolly Parton. Can you expand on that a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, she was not afraid to use her feminine, she used whatever she had at her disposal to get ahead in that factory. And it was not easy. The men did not want to train her. They did not want her to succeed. And she did whatever it took. If the guys stood around laughing at a video of some naked woman farting, she would stand around with them and laugh, right? Like she paid a lot of attention to an older guy named Stan Settles who was literally knew how to run every single furnace. And, she kind of buttered him up and he ended up training her and teaching her all the things that initially none of the men really wanted her to know. And she, by the time I met her, she was kind of the veteran who was in charge of those furnaces, and she was the one in charge of training, and she was training the next woman. And so it was just interesting, because we never think about, at least in my world, we think a lot about breaking glass ceilings in law firms or in government. We don't think about the blue collar context, but there was a social revolution on the factory floors as women wanted to become machine operators, as black people became machine operators. And we forget about that a lot of times. So that was really eye opening to me.
And you make the point that has obviously parallels to what's going on in Washington right now, but the needs of blue-collar women, say, working in factories, really aren't part of the conversation. I mean, when we talk about some of these issues, I thought that was one of the better points you made, that they have some needs that can be met through public programs that really aren't talked about a lot.
Well, we're seeing it right now. Right now, actually, for the first time, there was an attempt to make family leave, like paid leave for maternity. And we're one of the few countries, industrialized countries in the world, that doesn't give you paid time off to have a baby. And yet, I have made the point in the past, and one of the reasons is that people who make decisions probably already have paid time off to have a baby, right? When I had my baby, my company gave me time off. But I don't know that women are getting that in the factory. And so, you know, I'm kind of depressed right now because I think that they're not going to be able to get it through. But that is what Democrats are fighting for right now, just for the record. I think a lot of times when it comes to women's rights, we talk a lot about corporate boards and negotiating and leaning in, negotiating salaries like a man, you know, the stuff that impacts like highly educated women. But there's a need at the bottom to talk about, you know, these blue collar women and what they're not getting at work.
There's a lot of obvious other things that happen when a factory closes that I think people don't pay particular attention to that impact the broader community. And boy, we've seen it around here. And you deal with that in real life cases in the book. And some of it deals with the problems with some of these retraining programs.
Oh, yeah.
And, what did you find on it? It just seems strange to me that we can't do a better job at that.
Yeah, I mean, look, the economy is changing so fast. That's part of it. I initially thought that the steelworkers I followed were kind of being short-sighted by not taking advantage of the retraining more. And then when I looked into it, I realized that people who do the retraining tend to earn less than those who don't. And that was an eye-opener to me. I think part of the reason is that most of these workers just wanted to get another job pretty quickly. And they thought there was a lot of red tape and hoops they had to jump through in order to even get the retraining approved. You couldn't just do whatever you wanted, that you had to get the class approved. You had... And so that was part of it. So I think the ones who ended up doing the retraining, maybe, this is just my hypothesis, were ones who couldn't always get a different job. That's one theory. But like one of the guys I followed in the book, Tim, became a truck driver. He got his CDL, and the lifestyle didn't work for him very well. But also we're looking at having driverless cars in a few years. So, like, yeah. You know, what do you go and get trained for that you're sure to get a job? I think that's part of the issue is technology is making that such a moving target. That's one issue. And the other is that, you know, these workers had skills. They had a lot of skills that were hard to quantify because they trained each other, right? And so much of the training that they'd gotten on the factory floor was just, you know, one union brother or sister to another. And yet Shannon was able to run all these very complicated furnaces. But because no university or no certified program came to say, yes, you can, you know, you're certified in heat treat, it was harder for her to go take that to another plant. I think she probably could have ultimately gotten on again in heat treat somewhere, but she just didn't think there was a future in it. So part of it is that they lose faith in the idea that they're ever going to get another job that's gonna be a forever job. So they, by the end, they were all feeling like manufacturing is a dying breed, I'm a dying breed, you know, nothing I know is useful in this economy. And I don't think that's true, but I can see how they felt that way. I sure can.
You're listening to Heartland Politics on WVIK Public Radio in the Quad Cities. This is your host, Robin Johnson, and my guest today is Farrah Stockman, who's a member of the New York Times editorial board, a Pulitzer Prize winner with the Boston Globe for her reporting. She's the author of a new book called American Made, What Happens to People When Work Disappears. She follows three individuals and more people, but the focus is on three individuals when a factory closes, which is a topic that we're very aware of in this region, of course, with the decline of manufacturing jobs as a result of globalization and trade agreements. I think it is the most interesting angle that makes this book really stand out to me is your personal journey. You share your thoughts, how you maybe looked at these issues differently before you really dove into this. And I appreciate that, because I think a lot of people come in and write about this and go back and don't really reflect on that. But how did this impact your view of globalization and trade and its impact on our, well, on just not our economy, but our life and culture?
Yeah, for sure. No, I had always been taught that trade was, a win-win. It's a net positive. It's good for everyone. And if every country does what it's good at, then we'll have maximum efficiency and wealth will be created and we'll all be better off. And, you know, that's what I learned in Ec 10 in college. And that's what every diplomat, every business leader, every economist I'd ever interviewed, that's what they were telling me. And so, when you go face to face with people who are losing their jobs, you have to kind of reflect on it. And so I started questioning some of the things I'd been taught, particularly about NAFTA, and started to realize, okay, there's something else here. There's something else going on. I do think that a lot of people made a lot of money on NAFTA, on trade agreements, and there are real benefits, right, from globalization and trade. Anybody who shops at Walmart and buys a $10 jacket is benefiting from it. But at a certain point, I had to come to the conclusion that the greatest benefits go to those who are the most educated, those who have money already, and they can take advantage of opportunities to sell their products overseas. And the downsides of these agreements fall on the shoulders of workers who have the least, right? Because they're now competing with people who earn $1 a day or people who earn $3 a day. And it's really crying out for a solution, because those of us who, if you consider yourself a liberal, if you consider yourself someone who supports labor, who supports the working people, we went through a labor movement. We went through a civil rights movement. We went through a women's rights movement so that American workers could earn a decent wage and live a middle-class life with a factory job. And as soon as you get all those, minimum wage, healthcare, all of those things, as soon as those things come, the factories start leaving. And so we have to have an answer for that. And we haven't come up with a great answer, frankly, so far. And, some people say, well, let's just tax the rich, the people who have been making money off this stuff, tax them and give us a check. But I found a lot of the blue-collar people that I was following, they wanted to work. They wanted a place in the economy. They didn't want to live off a check. And they knew people who lived off a check, and they didn't respect them. So it's really a challenge to us as a society. And it's not just the United States, but Europe is also going through this. You see it in Britain. People are struggling with what to do with these blue-collar workers that had made decent money, and now their job is going away. And the whole structure of the economy now is becoming a service economy, and we're not making stuff. And, that's an oversimplification, because, of course, automation is here as well, and there are things that are being made in the United States, but they're the factories that are making them and those factories that are competitive on American soil don't tend to employ all that many people.
And in the broader look you take here at globalization involves immigration as well, and I think you kind of had a journey on that, where, again, just trying to understand this, I guess, from the people at the ground level and how they view things, and not just making a knee-jerk reaction that they're a bunch of racists.
Well, I could see, people do often come to that conclusion. And I have to say, there's been this big debate. You can see it in the media. Is it, did people vote for Trump because of economic anxiety or racial anxiety? And I'm like, when you really look at people's lives, there isn't any difference. Mm-hmm. It's impossible to disentangle the two. If somebody is angry that their job is moving to Mexico or that their job is moving to China, is that economic or racial, right? If somebody is angry that the blue-collar jobs that remain in their town are, like, roofing or pouring cement are increasingly being done by undocumented immigrants, is that economic insecurity? Is that, or is that racism? Like, you know, when you bring it down to jobs, you can kind of see where, why people want walls, why they want tariffs, why they want to keep the world at bay. And, you know, I don't personally know if that's the best solution, but I can see where, I can start to understand where that instinct comes from. Even though I've been on the other side of the coin, and every job I've ever had has been about the increasing interdependence of the world. I was a foreign affairs reporter. I was a reporter covering an international tribunal. You know, I've lived abroad. I've enjoyed the fruits of that and had a wonderful life, but it's important to see the other side.
You encapsulate all this in the comment you make over and over in the book that the effects of globalization are shouldered by the most vulnerable Americans, and I think that's a key point that maybe the folks setting policy have lost track of. It seems their solutions to globalization are, well, we're going to retrain you, which Bill Clinton said, which you documented hasn't been very effective, or hey, go move where the jobs are, you know, which is a really kind of condescending.
Right.
Attitude towards how these people are going to try to make their own American dream happen.
Yeah, I mean, one of the big things that happen, I guess I don't want to have a spoiler alert, but there are people who move out of the country from this factory. That was the biggest shock to me, is out of 300 people, two of them left the country for a place they felt would... they could live on their savings. They sold everything they own and bought a one-way ticket. Which is like, whoa, that was not what I expected to see.
Yeah.
But if you start to feel like, okay, I've already been through two plant closings, I'm 55 years old, my arms hurt, my back hurt, I don't want to go into another plant and start at the bottom tier and I have no seniority and I'm not going to, and I don't even know how long this plant's going to last. So, you know, you can start to see people's choices. And, you know, Indianapolis is not, you know, there's a lot of things happening in Indianapolis. There's jobs coming. There's a lot going on there. But is it for blue-collar people? That, you know, that was sort of one of my questions. A lot of the jobs that are coming, like Salesforce and Angie's List and some of these tech jobs are happening in Indianapolis. And so I'm hoping there will be more blue-collar opportunities, but so many of the jobs are for folks with a different skill set. And, you know, you had to have gone to college. And so to me, like, that was another big takeaway, is that most of the decisions in the country are made by people with college degrees, law degrees, PhDs, master's degrees, and yet two-thirds of Americans don't have a BA. And so, you know, that tells you right there that there is a big disconnect between the economic realities of the people who are making the decisions and the ones who are having to live with those decisions.
And then COVID comes along. Which kind of buttresses your point as well about globalization, that maybe we saw there, that with all the supply lines globally, that and I'm certainly not suggesting we put up walls or anything, but I do think, like, you've come to realize that there's a lot of ramifications to this that I just don't think our policymakers have thought through.
Well, we've kind of been allergic to the idea of having an industrial policy in this country. We've said, you know, capitalism is, you know, freedom. People will be most creative. The economy will be most vibrant if we just let the money go where it should go. And, you know, folks will figure it out. And a lot of people, when I, you know, I have friends who are hedge fund guys, they'll say, well, this is no different than the, you know, than when the farmers went to the city to work in the factories in the first place, or when the, you know, the original Teamsters who rode these, you know, had these horse and carriage buggies, and then they ended up working in auto plants. And, you know, upheaval happens. This is part of change. And I, you know, there's a lot of truth to that, but it doesn't make it any easier for the folks who are having that change forced upon them. And I also just think that there is the fate of the companies, the fate of the decision makers is no longer directly tied to the workers anymore, because now what we used to think what was good for an American company was good for America and good for American workers. That's not the case anymore. Now these companies are multinationals. They have customers all over the world. They have workers all over the world. And I really just think that when we, you know, we have to think a little bit more carefully about how we create an economy that has a place for everyone, you know, particularly blue-collar workers.
We got about 1 minute left, and we just barely touched the surface of this book, and I really encourage folks to take a look at it and go get a copy and read it. It's so relevant to our area and our times. But was there one thing that surprised you in a positive way the most in writing this book and doing your research?
Surprised me in a positive way.
We've covered the stuff kind of in the negative stuff, but let's end on a positive note.
Well, I just, you know, the relationship between the workers, their love for each other, their camaraderie, I mean, that really came through. And I, you know, they are leaning on each other even to this day to find new jobs and to, you know, to just create, make meaning out of their lives. They still meet up and have, you know, some of them do. And so I just, you know, I was surprised by that and heartened that, you know, they had that kind of bond, and it helps them get through tough times. I think that was one positive. And across racial lines, across gender, you know, they did have a lot of interracial friendships in that plant. And I think that sometimes gets lost when we write about this stuff.
It's just not a factory, it's a community. And I think that's an important point that gets lost, that the factory was closed, but a community was destroyed. But still, some remnants of it still exist, which is a good thing. Farah, I really want to thank you for being a guest, and it's an excellent book. Again, I recommend it, called American Made, What Happens to People When Work Disappears. Very timely, very important to our ongoing discussions. And Farah Stockman's been my guest today on Heartland Politics. Farah, thank you again.
Hey, thanks a lot for having me on.
Heartland Politics is a production of WVIK, Quad Cities NPR. If you enjoyed this conversation, you can hear more on the Heartland Politics podcast, available at WVIK.org, in the WVIK app, or wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.